Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. For today's Arts and Culture Show, we're talking about women who are blazing trails in their creative fields. I'm Jade Hindman. Here's to conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. A local author explores class, immigration, and the expense of the American dream in her new book.
The book centers around the Shaw family, and an incident of police violence happens to their 12-year-old son.
Plus, an upcoming ballet showcase features women who are dance makers, and Midday Movies showcases a few trailblazing directors who are women. That's ahead on Midday Edition.
KPBS On Demand is supported by San Diego Opera, presenting Madama Butterfly, Puccini's timeless tale of betrayal and tragedy, featuring an all-star cast and the San Diego Symphony. Two performances, April 26th and 28th, at the Civic Theater. Tickets at sdopera.org.
Welcome in, San Diego. It's Jade Hindman. Today we're talking about arts and culture and the women blazing trails in the creative field. This is Midday Edition, connecting our communities through conversation. Immigration, class tensions, and generational divides all come together in the new book, A Great Country. It follows the Shaws, a close-knit Indian-American family trying to fit into their new community. But when they find out the police have beaten and arrested their 12-year-old son, their world is suddenly turned upside down. As that violent incident ripples across the community, the Shaws start to wonder, what is the price of the American dream? This is local author Shilpi Samaya Gowda's latest novel. She'll be celebrating the book's launch on March 24th at Diesel Bookstore and on March 30th at the Carlsbad Library. She joins me now. Shilpi, welcome back to Midday.
Great to be with you.
Can you briefly describe to us what A Great Country is about?
A Great Country is the story of a community, a fictional community in Southern California, kind of in the Orange County area. And there are multiple families from different ethnic backgrounds, different immigration statuses, different levels of socioeconomic comfort and privilege. And they all interact with one another in this neighborhood and in this school community. And the book centers around the Shaw family, and an incident of police violence happens to their 12-year-old son. And that sort of throws the family into a tailspin, and it also forces a reckoning within their community.
Yeah, this book really reflects the current moment. What inspired you to write it?
You know, and I started thinking about this idea in 2020 and began writing it in 2021. And it was just on the heels of my last book being published. And obviously, along with everybody else in the world, I was, really shaken by the events that were transpiring, not just the pandemic and all of the, associated life changes. But, I was watching as incidents of violence against Asian Americans were on the rise, really for the first time in many years. And I watched the video of George Floyd along with many other Americans and was horrified by that. And I that incident in particular made me reflect on a personal experience I'd had 30 years earlier when I had been an intern for the Minneapolis Police Department while I was in college. And while that had been a very eye-opening experience, 30 years later, I was sort of trying to understand how, what I was watching on that video could transpire. So all of the things that were sort of happening in America, that the lack of civil discourse, the infighting, the extremism, I think I just was watching and observing that, and I found myself longing for a different kind of dialogue, one in which people could really listen to one another, listen to their neighbors, and be heard, have their opinions heard, and maybe try to move towards, some sort of level of understanding or even compromise. So this book was sort of born out of that period and watching that transpire and wanting to reach for something different.
You mentioned interning with the Minneapolis Police Department. What did you see there?
Well, I think I was about 19 or 20 at the time. So it was a very eye-opening experience. I spent most of my time riding along at night in patrol cars and just going to whatever calls the police officers were called to. And so I saw a lot of eye-opening things. I saw different slices of society than I hadn't seen before, as someone who'd had a typical sort of suburban upbringing. And then I also watched the interaction of the officers with the communities. They were very entrenched. They knew people. They knew, they all knew one another's names. They had regular relationships where they worked to keep one another apprised and informed and safe. And I saw the bravery of a lot of officers as well, putting their lives on the line every day. So, obviously I probably had a varnished view since I was an intern. But, I later, worked to try to reconcile or at least make sense of that experience and what I'd seen that summer, with what I later saw.
Well, I mean, so then how did you reconcile that experience with these horrific incidents of police brutality and violence?
Well, I think these incidents have always happened. It's just that they've become more visible to us with, the rise of everybody having a camera phone and, the ubiquity of being able to capture things by civilians. And so obviously nothing is a monolith. Police officers are not a monolith. Criminals are not a monolith. There's diversity and variegation in every community. So I think that I'm not sure reconcile is really what I've been able to do. I think I have a broader understanding of the differences that can occur within any group or community. And I don't think one necessarily negates the other. So, I still believe that a great majority of police officers are brave and, work hard to keep their community safe. But it also means that the things we've seen in the news are also true, and that different communities have different experiences, with the police. So I think my understanding has broadened to encompass all of those things. And I think that's one thing we could all stand to learn a little bit instead of, sort of taking a polarized position.
Yeah. And so that brings us to your book. The first part of this book takes place over one night, getting the call that your child's been arrested. I mean, that's something no parent ever wants to go through. Was that difficult to write about?
The fact that the first half of the story unfolds, really over one evening was very different compared to my previous novels, which most of which, take place over many years or decades. So there was definitely a challenge in trying to pack all of that dynamism and those plot points into, a very tight time frame and imagine what it would feel like, minute by minute, hour by hour, for this whole family that's being, thrust into this situation that they never experienced. But I think that also was exciting for me as a writer, to be able to write in a different way and to sort of conceive of the story in a different way. In terms of, terrible things happening to your child, I think, you know, that's one of the things I've learned to do as a writer. I mean, from my first book, which, you know, really Secret Daughter focuses on, you know, the death of an infant girl at birth because she's a girl in rural India. And so that's probably the hardest thing I've had to imagine as a parent. But there really is an element of being able to put yourself into someone else's shoes and develop an empathy for what, you know, what they're going through. And I think there's a universality to parenthood and to the worries and concerns we all carry, no matter, you know, what those circumstances are.
You know, what I find so interesting about this book that you wrote is that we're not just following this one family. We're actually hearing from their whole community. Why did you want to zoom out and tell this story from so many different perspectives?
Yeah, that was one of my main goals in telling this story this way was, you know, I think back to the inspiration for the book, seeing what was unfolding in communities and neighborhoods in 2020 and 2021 really made me realize again how interrelated we all are. You know, we don't live in bubbles, and everything we do impacts our fellow citizens, and the same is true in the reverse. And so I thought it would really be interesting to show a broader view of how various people, various families from different backgrounds within, you know, a single neighborhood respond to the same event differently and how it affects their understanding and how it might unfold given their life perspectives. I think that's part of what we, you know, what we miss when we're just following the story of a single person or a single family is that, you know, the truth or the story or the event can be perceived differently depending on, you know, what you bring to it.
Yeah. Speaking of community, the Shahs are really trying to fit into this neighborhood. Tell us more about that and how you're representing class divides in this book.
Yeah, the Shah family moves from, you know, more of a new immigrant middle-class neighborhood where they're surrounded by people similar to them, you know, other immigrants that they have been there for a similar amount of time, to, you know, they catapult themselves into this very upper class neighborhood where there's not really anybody that looks like them around. And so they feel a sense of isolation that I think they didn't expect to, particularly because they go into this time of crisis soon after moving. And so they're not entrenched enough in their new neighborhood to have developed friendships and relationships amongst people who can support them. So they're sort of caught in between. You know, I think it's this very classic dilemma of the American dream is, you know, how much do you assimilate and try to climb the ladder and fit into, you know, this aspirational sense of what it means to achieve the dream, and how much do you hold on to what brought you to this country in the first place and maybe, you know, helped make you successful. And they really struggle with that. The Shah family struggle with that, and they have, you know, they find that most of their support and a sense of belonging that they feel still occurs in their old neighborhood. And so that's part of their learning about the shine coming off of what they thought was going to be the, you know, the answer to all their dreams.
Yeah. And you also come from an immigrant family. Can you tell us more about your relationship to the U.S. and India and how that influences your writing?
Well, my parents were immigrants from India to Canada, and I grew up there. And I've lived in the United States since I came here for college. So more of my life has been spent here than I spent in Canada. But I think growing up, I got used to toggling between two different worlds, not just the country of India, where all my family still, my extended family still lived, and the country of Canada, but the, you know, the two different cultures, the one I had at home with my parents, which was very steeped in all things Indian culture, music, food, values, and the sort of westernized culture I had at school with my friends and peers. And so I think that in some sense has been good practice for me as a person and as a writer, because I can usually see multiple sides of things. You know, I usually understand as a little bit of an observer standing outside, that, you know, there are particularities to any culture or any community. And so even in the United States, I've lived in California for a long time, but I've lived in New York City and the South. And so I've been able to, you know, observe and witness all of those subcultures. And in a sense, I feel like I've taken something with me from all those places I've lived and all the people I've met, and they're all part of a whole now. So I don't really feel, you know, people will often say, like, do you feel more Indian or more American or more Canadian? And my answer is yes, I feel all of those things. They're all sort of part of the mosaic of me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what do you want readers to take away from this book?
As I said before, I really am hoping to start a different kind of dialogue. Part of the reason I ended up representing so many different points of view in this book, I mean, even the police officers, there are, you know, three or four points of view within, you know, that group, I really hope people will both find something to identify with. You know, they will, I think, are likely to find a point of view or perspective that represents their own. But then I'm also hoping that they will see another one that they don't necessarily identify with, but they're willing to read about and listen to and maybe try to understand a little bit. I do think that is one of the greatest powers that fiction can have, is that, you know, it enables us to step into somebody else's shoes and to feel a little bit of what their life might be like. And hopefully that's a, you know, a way of building some bridges to understanding and conversation in our country.
I've been speaking with author Shilpi Somaya Gowda about her book, A Great Country. She'll celebrate the launch of the book this Sunday, March 24th at Diesel Bookstore. Shilpi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jade.
Coming up, a contemporary ballet company is putting on a showcase featuring all women choreographers.
When we say contemporary ballet, it is very much making it relevant.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition.
Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year, we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Female dance makers are the spotlight of an upcoming ballet showcase. The Rosenbox Project will kick off its 2024 season with Empower, which starts tonight and runs through March 30th. KPBS arts producer and editor Julia Dixon Evans sat down with Rosenbox founder Carly Topazio to talk more about the showcase. She started out by asking if women are typically undervalued or underrepresented in the dance world. Take a listen.
I think typically when we think about classical ballet or contemporary ballet, it's predominantly women. You know, it's a female-dominated industry. However, the reality is that majority of individuals, you know, in administration, in executive, or in choreographic positions are males. So it's very important to us to spotlight females and to give that space to, you know, kind of platform and empower more female voices.
I want to ask about some of the pieces of choreography in the show. Can you tell me about the dance that you have created for Empower?
Of course. So the piece that I created is called Asymptote, and it is definitely much more abstract. It kind of follows that, you know, the idea of parabolas and peaks and valleys and kind of an abstract landscape within that, like two points inching closer together, but never really quite meeting. And so it's kind of that concept deconstructed in, again, more of like an abstract landscape.
I'm curious how that might look on stage. It seems very mathematical. Can you describe what it looks like?
Absolutely. It definitely is mathematical. It's a bit of a departure from typically what I like to do, which is exploring, you know, kind of the human condition and interactions between individuals in a very human sense. So it is much more centered around movement and shapes. So there's a lot of curvature, and I kind of have been joking with the dancers that it's a parabolic experience, you know, within their movement, but also the shapes that their bodies are making and the architecture and the formations that the dancers as a whole are creating. So it's very flowing, but also, you know, kind of has pulls that kind of mathematical idea into not just the shapes and movement, but also the timing and the musicality and the rhythmic kind of ebb and flow of the entire piece.
And you also have a guest choreographer, Charisse Barton. What is it like bringing in outside voices to what's a tight-knit company?
We love bringing in outside voices. I think it's one of the most exciting things because we are such a close, tight-knit group of artists. You know, in a sense, sometimes we get very comfortable with one another and kind of becomes almost like, you know, completing each other's sentences. So it's always highly anticipated by all the artists when we do bring in outside voices, because it's not just kind of an exercise to like stretch our versatility and expand upon our habitual movements and, you know, where our comfort zones are, but it's also a huge source of inspiration. You know, there are so many incredible artists throughout the country, throughout San Diego, and so bringing in guest artists is an incredible opportunity to expand our repertoire, expand individual artists' versatility and kind of exposure as well. And it's also really exciting to be able to share that with our audiences.
And who is Charisse Barton? Tell me about her work.
Yes, Charisse Barton is a choreographer, a director, and an educator. She's based out of LA, and she has a history of dancing professionally. She's from Canada, but rose kind of to prominence with her work on Broadway and on film and screen. And this is kind of a unique opportunity because she reached out to us as she has choreographed for concert dance before, but it has been sort of a long departure from that as she, you know, kind of went into Broadway and film and screen. And so this is, she felt following the pandemic, this was kind of the perfect opportunity to kind of go back to what she loves, which is creating for live performance, for concert dance, and working with a professional company again.
Can we zoom out a little bit and talk about contemporary ballet? What are the distinctions between contemporary dance, traditional ballet, and contemporary ballet?
Absolutely. So I think the, you know, most obvious distinction between contemporary and classical ballet is the contemporary aspect of it. You know, ballet, typically classical, it has been done for decades or centuries. And when we say contemporary ballet, it is very much making it relevant, you know, building upon this traditional art form to make it a little bit more relatable, to create and produce productions that are relatable, but also are, you know, reflective of the current time. And I think the distinction between contemporary dance and contemporary ballet is that element of ballet. You know, contemporary dance can be a little bit more influenced by many other styles, whereas contemporary ballet does still have at its core that classical traditional ballet aspect to it, but with a twist, making it a little bit more modern and a little bit more relevant, and also kind of pushing the boundaries of what it has been typically considered or perceived as.
And do most dancers, like the ones in your company, do they set out to be contemporary ballet dancers, or is it kind of a journey that gets them there?
I definitely think it's a journey. I think, you know, everyone is different. And I think in the world of dance, there are so many different disciplines and style focuses. Within our company, all of our dancers have began with classical training and have reached a professional level in classical ballet. And I think that's kind of where the contemporary comes in, because I don't want to undermine classical ballet. I think it's beautiful, but I think it comes to a point where there's almost this feeling of wanting a little bit more. And I think contemporary ballet and contemporary dance allows for that opportunity to, you know, explore more, to connect a little bit deeper, rather than just strictly doing steps or refining a technique. It's bringing a little bit more of a human aspect into it.
I love that. And, you know, the last few years have been very volatile for the performing arts. I don't know if you've heard. I was wondering if you could give us a little temperature check on how things are for dance companies right now. Like, what are some of the challenges you're dealing with, or what are the concerns that are top of mind?
I think always the top of mind concern is being able to share this art form with our patrons, with audiences. I think it's no secret that, you know, post-pandemic, it has been a very slow return back to the theater, back to live performance, you know, at the size and at the capacity that we saw pre-pandemic. But I think that there is a shift, a growing need for more artists, or I guess a growing desire for artists to want to engage and want to perform and connect with audiences. And so I think, yeah, that filling theaters and reaching, having those in-person human moments for connection, to build community, I think that has always been at the forefront. But I think particularly now, it has become a little bit more of a focus point, and I guess a bit of a struggle.
And you launched your company, The Rosenbachs, in 2018. What do you think has made it so resilient during the last 6 years? And also kind of what drives you to keep making dance like this that reflects the current moment?
That's a good question. I think the resilience comes from the passion of not just one, but an entire community and family of artists, and greater community that we have began to develop with our audiences, with our participants, with our students. That need to share and connect is extremely vital. And I think that is absolutely what continues to drive us in everything that we do.
That was KPBS Arts producer and editor Julia Dixon Evans speaking with Carly Topazio about the Empower Showcase. Performances will run from March 21st through the 30th at Liberty Station. Up next, Midday Movies celebrates Women's History Month by highlighting women directors and trailblazers.
Well, when I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
We'll take you from sassy Mae West to Oscar-winning director Kathryn Bigelow. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Toyota, on a journey toward an electrified future with more options in their lineup of electrified vehicles, offering a choice of powertrain that gives Toyota electric vehicles a balance of power and efficiency. To learn more, visit toyota.com. Toyota, let's go places.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. March is Women's History Month, so Midday Movies is celebrating women filmmakers. Once again, our film critics are KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace's podcaster Yazdi Puthavala. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jade.
So let's start this discussion with a look at some trailblazing women. Beth, you have an example from the early days of Hollywood, Mae West.
Yes. So in case you don't know who Mae West is, here are just a couple of quick one-liners from her.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I see a man in your life.
What, only one?
I changed my mind.
Does it work any better?
So Salvador Dali and Andy Warhol used her as inspiration. The Coke bottle is supposedly inspired by her shape, and she was the highest paid performer in Hollywood at one point in the 1930s. So Mae West was a buxom, wisecracking, platinum blonde with a voracious appetite for men. She never directed her own films, but she was always in complete control of her brand and her career, and she was a creative force behind all of them. She began in vaudeville. She wrote her own plays that she starred in, and she also wrote her songs, like this one called I Wonder Where My Easy Rider Has Gone.
I've bought since Miss Susan Johnson, she lost the Jockey League. There's been much excitement and more to be. You can hear her moaning from early morn. I wonder where my easy rider's gone. I wonder where my easy rider's gone.
She made her debut at 40 in 1932, and she had just a bit part in a movie, but she wrote her own memorable lines, and a year later, she was already the star of two movies, She Done Him Wrong and I'm No Angel. Fortunately, her screen debut came in pre-code Hollywood, so this was before a lot of the strict censorship came into play, and that was important because she played women who defied social mores and in a way that was, like, still uncommon today, I think. She was playing women who were independent, sexually liberated, never needed a man, but could always put one to good use. And she was sexy, but also kind of poking fun at her own image. And even when they tried to censor her, she could just, like, give a little moan or a little eye roll, and she could make almost anything sound dirty and suggestive. But I just feel like she is such an amazing person in terms of challenging what was going on at the time, making an image for women that was unique, still is unique. She single-handedly saved Paramount Pictures from bankruptcy in the early 30s, and she continually fought against stereotypes. She championed women's rights, gay rights. She even at one point was dating a black boxer, or I'm not sure dating is a good word for Mae West, but she was friends with a black boxer, and her building wouldn't let him come in through the front door. So she simply bought the building and changed the policy. So I just feel like she's such an amazing person on screen and off, and just really sets the stage for a lot of amazing things to come.
Yeah, Steve, what are your thoughts on Mae West?
Oh, she's altogether wonderful. All you need to do is watch 10 minutes of any one of her films on YouTube, and her charm is intact like a whole century later. I also think she was very foundational for every kind of woman, not just in movies, but in popular culture, who followed in her steps, you know, who have broadly embraced their sexuality and asserted themselves outside of the influence of men. So anyone from Madonna to somebody like Pam Grier to even Rebecca Ferguson, in current cinema, I think they're all following in her footsteps, and they're grateful for her.
Well, she sounds like she was definitely a trailblazer. And Yazdi, you look to a more recent trailblazer, and she is a director. Tell us about Nicole Holofcener.
So Nicole Holofcener is a more contemporary filmmaker, and I adore her because she makes films about ordinary people leading middle-class lives in America. She's made movies such as Walking and Talking and Lovely and Amazing, which, by the way, is actually a film that is lovely and amazing. There's a real lived-in reality to her films, which are kind and wise, and they carry gently feminist ideals. And they almost always feature a modern professional woman at the center. She herself grew up in the 60s and 70s and spent her time as a child on Woody Allen films because her father was a film producer and her mom a set decorator. And she started her career writing, and her other films include Friends with Money, Please Give, Enough Said, and most recently, You Hurt My Feelings. The last two are wonderful collaborations with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but she's also worked with female leads like Catherine Keener, Emily Mortimer, Jennifer Aniston, and Frances McDormand. The one commonality through all of her films is, like I said, they have a female protagonist who is trying to make do with the very modern world around them. And I just want to live in the world of her films. They're deeply empathetic. She's also directed television on everything from Sex and the City, Gilmore Girls, 6 Feet Under, and she more recently has written movies Can You Ever Forgive Me, as well as The Last Duel. And here is a clip from her second film, Lovely and Amazing, which features Catherine Keener as the lead. And this clip is of her interacting with a very young Jake Gyllenhaal.
Hi, I'd like to apply for the job.
No way.
Why not?
You look like my mom.
If I haven't developed pictures before, will somebody train me?
I will.
Don't look at me like that. You just said I look like your mom.
My mom's cute.
Well, I know asking this next question will be hard for the both of you, but do you have a favorite woman director or a woman director that you'd like to highlight for people to seek out? Yazdi, who do you recommend?
After I pared down my list of about 50 names, the one that I want to highlight is Meera Nair. She's an Indian director who first had a hit with the film Salaam Bombay and quickly followed with success in Hollywood. She's an Indian-American filmmaker who started as a documentarian, and subsequent to Salaam Bombay, she's made Mississippi Masala, Monsoon Wedding, The Namesake, and The Reluctant Fundamentalist. Her production company, Mirabai Films, have furthered the cause of Indian cinema in the U.S. perhaps more than any other person. And her films have, like, color and light to them, but they're also very deeply steeped in reality and the darker themes, and often pondering on mortality. Here is a clip from Meera Nair's first English-language film, Mississippi Masala, also featuring a very young Denzel Washington. And it's about an interracial relationship between Sarita Chaudhry and Washington's character. And here is a clip about Chaudhry arguing with her parents when they first find out that she's dating a black man, and the subsequent gossip that emerges amongst her family and friends.
What do you know about him? What about his family?
This is America, Ma. No one cares.
We care. Your father and I. You are our only child. If we don't care, who will?
Do you know what she told her mother?
Hey, Jaya.
Just wait, I'm telling you. I love him, that's not a crime. Yeah, can you imagine dumping Harry Patel
for a black?
I'm sending my Namita to India as soon as possible. Hey, Jaya, they get ideas from each other, and then it spreads like a disease.
Can I speak to Meena, please?
There's no Meena Sheena here.
And Beth, are you also a fan?
Yes, I am. I'm a big fan of Salaam Bombay. It's one of my favorite films, although it's a bit heartbreaking in places. Since she did start working in documentaries, I love kind of the way she brings that sense of reality and capturing kind of a naturalism in her scenes. So I enjoy all of her films. I enjoy her career path that she's taken, and that she continues to explore kind of cultures and also cultures in clash.
So who would you like to highlight as your favorite director?
Okay, like Yazdi, it's really hard to pare down the list. And, you know, I would also mention someone like Ida Lupino, who was an early actress who turned to directing, and then someone like Lena Wertmüller, who was an international trailblazer. But I do have a special place in my heart for Kathryn Bigelow, because I'm an action junkie, and I love the fact that a woman director was able to make her mark in the action genre. You know, action films tend to be testosterone-driven, and there seems to be this view that only men can direct them. So I love how she just kind of muscled into this genre, proving that a woman can be just as good as a man directing these kind of films. And I also really appreciate that she has resisted stereotypes. And I mean that from both men and women. You know, she just does not look at making films is like, I'm a woman, so I have to deal with female issues or female-centric characters. I want to make films that are interesting to me on whatever level. And so, you know, she's made films like The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. But one of my favorites of hers, because it mixes horror, action, romance, and vampires, is Near Dark. Plus, it's what I call Paxtonated, and that means it has Bill Paxton in it. So here he is at a bar feeding. Woo!
It's finger licking good. Hey, Jess, I got smell like a Deadpool cat.
Bigelow is the first woman to win an Oscar for Best Director for The Hurt Locker. Yazdi, what do you think of her career?
I'm a fan of her career. She's made a wonderful movie called Strange Days, Zero Dark Thirty, of course. Similar to what Beth mentioned, I love the fact that if you watch one of her movies unknown, you won't know if it's made by a male or female director. So she almost transcends gender. You know, she makes very robust, visually striking movies. And it's been a while since she's made a film, and I can't wait to see what she does next.
All right. Well, let's bring this conversation up to the present day with some new films and new women directors. Yazdi, you have a film from last year that's streaming on Netflix. What is it, and who is the director we should watch?
So this is the debut film from director Chloe Dumont, and the name of the film is Fair Play. And I like the movie mostly for its script. It's a very sharp script that plays with the intersectionality between gender and power in the workplace. It tells the story of this boy and girl who both work at a hedge fund company, and they're having a relationship which they're keeping secret. And then a series of events transpire. They're both due for promotion, and everybody had presumed that he's the one who will get promoted, but she is the one who lands up getting promoted, and that starts the unraveling of their relationship and, you know, how every person is perceived in a workplace based on how they dress or how they look or what gender they are. I think it's a brilliant script. And as an example of the great writing, here is a scene between Phoebe Dynevor and Eldon Ehrenreich set later in the movie when she is actually trying to help him get a promotion.
Hey, we're going to go grab a drink. Do you want to join?
Have you heard of Miro? Sequoia-backed. It went public last month. Some say it's an overhyped unicorn, but Luke sourced it, ran the numbers, and thinks it could reel in some sizable returns.
For an overhyped unicorn?
Well, when they announced their plans...
Do you know how much Luke's last unicorn cost us?
50 million. Put it under a microscope before you move.
Of course.
But he's here to support your vision, not steer it.
You coming or not?
First round's on me.
Nice answer.
All right. Well, Beth, did you like the film?
I did, but not quite as much as Yazdi. I don't think I'm, like, really drawn to the hedge fund world as much as I am to, like, horror or something. So, and I did feel like Emily, the lead character, was, like, not quite as cutthroat as I thought she should be for how she's depicted in it. You know, she's given this promotion and she's kind of depicted as being very smart and savvy. So I had a few issues with her character, but I still liked the film. But I do tend to gravitate more towards women in horror. So there's people like Julia Ducournau, who did Raw and Titane, and Michelle Garza Cerveza, who did Husera. And those are kind of the directors that I tend to, the new women directors that I'm gravitating towards right now.
All right. And you have a new film that just opened. It's not exactly horror, but it is dark. Love Lies Bleeding from Rose Glass.
Yes, it is dark. So I loved Rose Glass's debut feature, which was Saint Maud. And I think it had probably one of the most spectacular and surprising endings of any film I have seen recently, or maybe in all time. It's like literally a couple of seconds at the end changed the complete tone of the film. Love Lies Bleeding is not quite as good, but I love it because she is still pushing the envelope in terms of style and narrative. This time she tackles a lesbian love story set against a backdrop of murder and bodybuilding. It kind of has a neo-noir quality to it. Kristen Stewart runs a gym where she spots Jackie, who's played by Katie O'Brien. She's a drifter on her way to a Vegas bodybuilding contest. So here's a little taste of the trailer.
You talked to your dad recently?
Why?
Give us a call.
Where did you appear from? Oklahoma. Yeah, I've never been anywhere but here.
What were you doing with that big girl?
So what you're not getting by listening to this trailer is Glass's audacious visual style. And she kind of abandons reality and heads into a surrealistic sort of venue or, you know, mode. And I find it really exciting that she doesn't feel tied to kind of depicting things in a realistic way. And I love that she's not interested in characters that are mainstream or likable in a traditional sense. She really embraces the fringes and she loves flawed, driven characters. So I just look forward to anything she does.
Yazdi, do you share the same enthusiasm?
I do. So you take an egg and you put it in boiling water for about 300 days. And what you get afterwards as the product is what this film is. I mean, this movie is insanely hard-boiled. It's so hard-boiled.
Okay. And
I haven't seen something this committedly pulpy on the big screen in a long time. I mean, it's set in the 80s, and the 80s vibe practically kind of oozes on the camera lens. You know, the hair is fried.
The hair
is deep fried. And the jeans have been washed 100 times through acid. But it's just really a, you know, like a high wire act of maintaining a tone. It wants to be kind of a 80s set erotic thriller, but it's also playing with surrealism. I think this movie is going to do very well years from now in midnight screenings. It's going to have, it has the absolute makings of a cult classic.
All right. Love Lies Bleeding is currently in cinemas and Fair Play is streaming on Netflix. That wraps up another Midday Movies. I want to thank KPBS Cinema Junkie Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace's podcaster Yazdi Pathavala. Thank you so much for joining us. It's always fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. If you missed it, you can always tap in to download the Midday Edition podcast wherever you listen. Don't forget to watch Evening Edition tonight at 5 for in-depth coverage of San Diego issues. The Roundtable is here tomorrow at noon. And before we go, I'd like to thank our Midday Edition team, producers Juliana Domingo, Andrew Bracken, Brooke Ruth, Ashley Rush, art segment contributors Julia Dixon Evans and Beth Accomando, technical producers Rebecca Chacon, Ben Redlosk, and Brandon Trufa. The Midday Edition theme music you hear is from San Diego's own The Surefire Soul Ensemble. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. I'll see you back here Monday. Until then, make it a great day on purpose, everyone.
Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.